Today is Wednesday, March 2, 2016. Welcome. Good afternoon. Welcome back. And let the record show that the House Resource Resources Committee was convened at 1:01 p.m. Present are Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Olson, my fellow co-chair, Representative Tiara Rico, and myself, Representative Benny Narell. Let the record reflect, we're going to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello to Julie from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO. This afternoon, we will continue to hear invited testimony regarding the potential impacts of House Bill 247. Because we have four presenters, we are limiting all presenters to 15 to 20 minutes. We will hold questions until the presentation is complete, then allow for 5-10 minutes so they can finish on time today at 3 p.m. That's wishful thinking on my part, but we're going to try. If you have specific questions beyond that, send those questions to my staff and I'll obtain answers and share those with committee members. This is a very important part of our part of the time hearing from the presenters, because we want to know what's going on. And I know it's been on going for a very long time, several days now, but you know, we've got to have informed decisions, and we have to make sure that our members get the right information and get to ask questions when they're not sure what's going on. And so you may this afternoon we'll continue to hear invited testimony regarding potential. Oh, I all did that. Welcome Mr. Jared Green and Moira Smith from NSTAR. Mr. Green is president and Ms. Smith is vice president and general counsel for the company. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Nagyet, Co-Chair Talarenko, committee members. I'm Jared Green, president of NSTAR Natural Gas Company, and as you noted, with me is Moira Smith, vice president and general counsel for NSTAR. We thank you for allowing us this opportunity to speak today. NSTAR is here as the largest purchaser of natural gas in the Cook Inlet today. Ultimately, our customers are a beneficiary of the tax credit program that has been in place since 2012. Our customers depend on natural gas from the Cook Inlet to heat their homes, their businesses, our schools, our hospitals, and our industries. Fundamentally, our interest is in the fostering of a stable and appealing natural gas environment for the Cook Inlet. This environment needs to exist in the short term, the medium term, and in the long term. NSTAR's number one priority is safe, reliable natural gas service to our customers. We were founded in 1959, the same year as statehood. On average, our customers use about 33 BCF of gas a year. In a really warm year, that can drop down as low as 30 BCF. A really cold year, it can be as high as 35 BCF. So we do have a fair weather impact, whether it's cold or whether it's warm.
Analytica. The record, Representative Tarr is here. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Analytica said the total in-state use is about 80 BCF right now. So we're on average about 33 of that 80. NSTAR also has very high seasonality to its gas needs. Moira will go through this in a little bit more detail, but from a high level, we generally vary from about 12-to-1 ratio of our winter to summer gas needs. The final aspect setting the stage is daily variability. We live in an environment that can have substantial variability in the gas demands due to weather. With the current customer base that NSTAR has, we have a potential daily demand of 287 million cubic feet of gas per day. This demand level, it's likely to occur in January, one of those nice cold snaps that we have. Now, we also have the potential of burning less than 100 MMCF per day on that exact same day if we're in a bit of a warm snap. A little bit of an example, right now we're at about 102.5 million per day is what we're producing through our system today. When NSTAR plans its natural gas portfolio, we look many years in advance. We operate in a small, closed supply network. It does require very long lead times when putting together what our portfolio will be. We need to know that we will have firm gas set for our customers at least 2 years in advance. Anything less really does put the marketplace at risk to supply shortages. In NSTAR's business, we must have gas available for our customers on those coldest days, no matter what. When it's 20 below in January, it's dark, it's evening time, every single one of our 140,935 customers must have their full gas needs met. So just a little bit on that, the customer count. That represents over 50% of the population of Alaska. So what does it mean to be a natural gas supplier to NSTAR? There's no doubt it is challenging to supply natural gas in the Cook Inlet today. NSTAR is the largest purchaser of natural gas, and we have the very demanding needs, as I just noted. Between our CINGSA storage facility and our producer contracts, we need to have that 287 million cubic feet per day available. However, we do not need this each and every day. This means that the producers in CINGSA need to have the significant capacity well beyond what the average production rates are. It also means that our producers need to have the operational capability to ramp up their production, but then also throttle it back when weather is getting warmer. This is a very, very different world than what the lower 48 has. With the integrated transmission and storage network, producers down there can simply drill a well, open up their taps 100%, and the very large market absorbs it. From a utility perspective, it's also a nice, easy world down there. Utilities have lineups of marketers trying to sell them gas. And if you have a contract in place and it isn't fulfilled for any reason, they simply have to go back to their trading screen, source the gas from one of the other thousands of suppliers who are willing to give them. We do not have that luxury up here. We have a very small and illiquid market with a handful of buyers and an even smaller number of suppliers. Layer onto that the fact that Conoco is selling its assets in the inlet, which will take another supplier out of the market, and it also shrinks the buying side because it effectively makes MLMP self-supplied, so they're no longer going to be purchasing from the active market. This leaves us with a very delicate marketplace. Now, I'm not saying that the sky is falling. We are in a much better place than we were in 2012. We have transitioned from a time where we were looking at shortages, both from a total supply and a deliverability perspective. Today, Moyer is going to talk to you about a contract that NSTAR has signed with Hilcorp. It's a key contract to our gas supply portfolio. This contract will take us out through 2023, which from NSTAR's view, this takes us just beyond the short-term window of what we look at. We're in a position right now where I have very good visibility out to 2021, where all of our gas is going to come from, decent visibility out to 2023, and with continuation of activity from Hilcorp, by Fury, by the revived Cook Inlet Energy, and hopefully other new players, such as Bluecrest or others entering the marketplace, I am optimistic that we will see our supply horizons moving out to the 2025s. However, that statement hinges on the continued activity of these and new producers in the inlet. We need to encourage and foster an environment which keeps the producers engaged. Now, I do strongly feel that the utilities have a very significant role and responsibility in encouraging this marketplace. From NSTAR's perspective, we have designed our portfolio to balance our number one priority of safe, reliable natural gas service with the need to foster the long-term viability of the inlet. We have put our support behind Fury's development of the kitchen lights unit, but we have also left open 10% of our supply portfolio for other producers to be able to come into. Since 2012, the state has also provided a huge support to the viability of the market in the Cook Inlet. NSTAR is cognizant of the short-term budget challenges facing the state at this time. NSTAR would love to see the state continue to help the encouragement of this marketplace in whatever form that encouragement may be, in order to keep this as an active, as an attractive investment for producers. Now, before I pass over to Moira, I do have one final note. As I mentioned, as of others over the last few days, we are in a relatively good place in the Cook Inlet right now. We are. However, weather has been very advantageous for us over the last 2 years, and so far in 2016, we're tracking really balmy as well. If we had experienced three cold winters, the current facilities may have been stretched. And also, as a reminder, as we sit today, we have one well into the kitchen lights unit. There are no gas-producing wells into the new Cosmoplay. We have four very large fields, which are very old and are aging more every single year. With cold weather, or if one of the existing platforms or fields has an issue, we do not have a contingency of significant backup alternatives. As this committee knows, we don't have any interties to the lower 48 or to Canada, and we are 100% dependent on this small, illiquid market to keep half of the state's population warm. So with that, Moira?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Moira Smith. I'm Vice President and General Counsel at NSTAR Natural Gas Company. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. This graph illustrates why, as we like to say, we're a complicated or a challenging customer for producers of natural gas in Cook Inlet. Any producer will tell you that they would like to produce wells at a consistent rate, open up the flow, sell it into a liquid market, and let the market bear what the price will be. This graph depicts the fact that we just don't purchase gas that way. It depicts the variability in our customers' daily demand, as well as NSTAR's actual daily supply in 2014 and 2015. So this is actual data as to which companies supplied gas on a day-to-day basis, represented by the different colors on the chart, and how much gas was consumed on each day of these 2 years, which is represented by the black line that tops off on most days in the chart. A couple of items are worth noting as you look at this. First, as I said, the day-to-day variability, we look like a squiggly audio line. It just changes every day as the temperature changes. Second is the seasonal variability. You see the peaks and the valleys, which are associated with winter and summer demand. And as Jared said, in winter, our customers can consume as much as 12 times more gas in a day in the winter than they do in the summer. Finally, have a look at the blue lines on the bottom of the slide. These represent CINGSA injections and withdrawals. Injections, of course, when they go below the bottom line, and withdrawals when they go above the bottom line. As you can see, on cold days, NSTAR withdrew significant volumes of gas from CINGSA to meet our customers' demand. Look, for example, at the middle of November 2015. For those of you who are from the Cook Inlet area, you may remember that it was one of the few cold moments in this otherwise balmy winter. And you can see the peak that occurs in the middle of November that represents that cold spike. Similarly, last winter was pretty warm, but in the middle of February it got very cold, and that is directly represented on the graph in February of 2015. On warm days, NSTAR injects gas into CINGSA. Our capacity to withdraw gas from CINGSA is 91 million a day. If you remember the key number of 287 million cubic feet per day, which Jared mentioned at the beginning, this accounts for about a third of that total daily withdrawal ability. The rest of our daily withdrawal ability has to be contracted under firm contracts with producers in the Cook Inlet. Having CINGSA available, though, is critical in light of the declining deliverability available out of Cook Inlet wells, which Analytica detailed for you, I think, on Saturday. Also, you'll see that there's an orange line up top, which represents that golden 287 million per day number that Jared talked about, which is needed on the coldest of cold days. Now, this day only comes along once every 10 years or so. We've had four such days in our company's history. But as Jared said, when that day comes, NSTAR has to be there with reliable gas to keep our pipelines pressurized and serve all of our customers. This next chart, slide 4, is a further illustration of the seasonality of our demand. This illustrates NSTAR's average daily deliverability in each month in 2019. Again, our goal is to have 287 million a day under contract or available from storage on each day and in every day of the year. But here you can see in blue, the darker blue wedge, is the Hilcorp contract Jared referred to, which I'll talk more about in a moment. The dark blue is firm deliveries. The light blue represents optional volumes that we can pull from that Hilcorp contract. Stacked on top of that is the Fury contract, which Jared referenced. That's firm deliveries under our new contract, and the light green represents optional volumes we can pull under that Fury contract. So if you look throughout the year, you can tell that what we expect and what we demand under our contracts from a producer in the middle of winter is quite different from what we demand in the summer, and producers have to be prepared to deliver that on a day-to-day basis. Finally, while not depicted here, we will be withdrawing from CINGSA. If you top out the top of the light green, you'll see that in January, which is typically our coldest month, we only have 150 million per day under contract in 2019. Add on to that the 91 million of contracted withdrawal capacity from CINGSA, and we're still only at 241 million. So we still have that gap of 46 million that we'll be looking to fill in the marketplace. This slide is starting today, looking out to 2023, sort of projecting what our gas supply will look like. If you look for a moment at 2016 and 2017, you'll notice that there are a lot of lines. There are a lot of different contracts represented in those 2 years. And those represent a variety of contracts, all of which will taper off in 2018. So in late 2014, we faced a future where starting in 2018, we would have sort of a cliff and no gas under contract from 2018 and beyond. We sent out a request for proposals and a request for bids from producers, all producers, potential and otherwise, in Cook Inlet, asking them to provide us with a bid to provide all of that firm gas to our customers. We then engaged in intensive, protracted negotiations with multiple producers and potential producers throughout 2015 and up until last Friday. Our first priority was to secure an anchor contract at reasonable prices, which could form the foundation for gas supply in the post-2018 world. These negotiations took a year and resulted in APL 14, the contract with Hilcorp, that was just filed with a regulatory commission for its approval on Monday. I'll talk a little bit about APL 14. It is a new agreement. It begins, deliveries will commence on April 1st, 2018. It will supply approximately 70% of our customers' needs from 2018 to 2023. It has, as I said earlier, both firm as well as optional volumes. And on a firm basis, it will supply around 22 billion cubic feet per year of gas. If you remember the light blue from a couple slides ago, it also offers some optional volumes that will really help NSTAR to manage its weather-related variability. As Jared said, our customers might consume 29 billion cubic feet in a year, or they might consume 35. From a planning perspective, this is challenging. And so this contract will help us to adjust our takes to ensure that we're not over-purchasing or under-purchasing as the circumstances may provide. Another key element of the contract is its reasonable price. You will remember that in 2013, the state of Alaska entered into a consent decree with Hilcorp, which resolved an antitrust investigation and set price caps for the sale of natural gas to Cook Inlet utilities. The price caps escalated at 4% annually. The weighted average annual price under APL 12, which is NSTAR's contract with Hilcorp, during its last year will be $8.33 per MCF. By contrast, the weighted average annual price for firm deliveries during the first contract year of APL 14 is $7.56 per MCF. This is almost a 10% decrease. Perhaps the most important feature of this contract is what it doesn't do. It does not meet all of NSTAR's gas supply requirements. What this means is that up until we signed our contract with Fury last week, 30% of our supply portfolio was available for other producers to fill. As a public utility, we value safety and reliability above all else. And so we understand the need to have a diversified supply portfolio. It diversifies supplier risk, but it also helps to foster investment and drilling, which is good news for the long-term stability of Cook Inlet supply. So now, between APL 14 and the new Fury contract, NSTAR has 90% of its needs met through 2021. To ensure that the market has a second chance to participate, we sent a second RFP to producers just this last Friday to try to acquire supply for the remaining 10% of our portfolio. We believe this contract represents a huge measure of stability in the Cook Inlet gas market. Indeed, if approved, it will be the most significant gas contract NSTAR has had approved in 15 years. Assuming commission approval, we will have laid the foundation of NSTAR's gas supply well into the next decade. Given where we were just 3 years ago, this is very good news.
So as I noted before, we are working with a very delicate market, a small number of buyers, very small number of producers. As Moira touched, we have contracts meeting most of our needs out through 2021, 2023, but we will need to negotiate extensions on those contracts within a few years. It is very important for all of South Central Alaska that we have a capable producer marketplace that will be there to provide the gas molecules and the deliverability that South Central Alaska needs. So those are our formal comments, so thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, first I hope a softball question through the chair for either of you. What is the docket calendaring on the RCA, on the application of the RCA?
We filed it on Monday, and public comment is due within 30 days.
All right, and may I?
Hold up.
I don't know much about RCA, a little bit more than I used to. What can we expect in terms of a ruling?
The timeline. So if the commission chooses not to suspend it into a docket, then they could approve it in 45 days' time, and that is what we've requested. If they feel the need to investigate, then they can suspend it into a docket, and they have, I believe, 6 months after that time to approve or reject the contract.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? I'm Attorney Representative Olson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this one's for Moira. The 2023 date, is that a result of the RCA limiting the length of the contracts that you can put out? Or is it possibly reluctance on the part of the producers to commit to something in 2023 without knowing what the tax regime will be at that time?
Through the Chair, Representative Olson. I'm not sure we can infer anything from the timeline in the sense that the producers were very willing to sit down with us and have conversations about extended term contracts. There's a fair amount of supply uncertainty as to what's going to happen in the mid-2020s. And so, if anything, I would say we were the ones who said, let's get a good chunk of time in there, but who knows what's going to happen in Cook Inlet and who knows about the pipeline from the North Slope.
Thank you.
Representative Keaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you coming today. You know, our presentation from our analysts said that $5 to $7 per MCF is sufficient to produce the most expensive gas in other jurisdictions around the world, and they cited Egypt and offshore Argentina, I believe, deep water. And from the 2009 consent decree, we were averaging 6+, and it sounds like you've negotiated through 2023 at 766. And so I'm trying to get your estimate of the validity of that statement. If that kind of a price is sufficient to produce the most expensive gas, the support that is in the market should be ample for economic development of gas for you guys. Do you guys agree with that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Very, very interesting question. Actually, let me click back to the cost that Analytica had put out of the cost to develop kind of the most expensive gas that's available. That would be the drilling, the lifting costs. But a lot of what will happen on that is then the assumption that you're able to produce at the full capabilities of your productions. You're actually able to crystallize the production coming off. You can produce a gas and sell it right away. As this graph shows, within this marketplace, there's a whole bunch of time where the producers have to just sit on the wells and not produce any gas at all. So they put a huge investment into the wells, and then it just sits there, and there's nobody to buy it from. And when we're sitting in the summer months, it's a really poor market to be selling into right now. If we were to have rolled back 3-4 years, and we have the Conoco LNG export facility, and it's 3-4 years, and it's even gone to kind of a year ago, it was exporting gas through the summer months. That created a much better balance of producers being able to produce relatively evenly throughout the year. That's effectively gone right now. I think... Some of my guys were saying April prices for LNG right now are sitting at about the $4.65 range. It's not going to be a great market for that facility to be selling off to. So producers in this area, with NSTAR being the largest buyer, they're kind of stuck with our buying patterns, and it does end up having an impact on the overall price because they're not able to do as much volume from that. Again, it's just that really tight, illiquid market that we're in. And we would absolutely love to be in a world of what we were a couple decades ago where NSTAR was noise. And that's kind of your ideal utility. You want to be just easy noise because we have very, very challenging demand profiles. If you have big, big industrial loads and you're just a little bit of a blip in the profile, then you can be easily taken care of. And prices are reflective of that. When you're the main load and we have very, very demanding needs, it creates a very, very challenging environment to be in. That enhances the need for storage. So the Singsa storage facility that was put in place in 2012, an absolute key and integral asset for the Cook Inlet. But as Moira touched, for NSTAR, that knocks off about a third of our deliverability needs. We still do need a lot more coming from that marketplace. And to build assets and have them ready to deliver, but then not being able to sell, there is a cost then that comes with that. So that would be kind of the qualitative way to reconcile the question that you were asking, I believe.
And I appreciate that. And of course, Analytica gave us three scenarios. The first one was a constrained market, which is where you're talking about. And if we want to drill large projects and have them sit idle, yeah, that's going to be a net loss to the state. I mean, obviously, in every scenario, no matter what the price was, it didn't support that if you're putting in massive amounts of credits just to sit there. The other scenarios they gave, though, was the one that you talked about, which would be export. And whether we don't need to do it for export. If you have an unconstrained market that can be sold off, if they can make a profit on that market, and I don't think that we want to be subsidizing just to make sure that if they have aren't making price, that we're subsidizing the export plants. The third one was looking at infield drilling, which is, you know, a lot of the options, and there was no scenario that they could find under which those were uneconomic. So it seems like the economics of those balance, unless we want to say that we want to invest $200-300 million every year of people's money to sit in the ground and just be available for whenever. So I guess, is that the policy decision that you see us looking at, either infield drilling, which is economic, or if they decide to do their own massive project, if they have unconstrained supply, or do we need the massive project just sitting there waiting for someone to turn on a spigot?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think akin to what I'm hearing there is having the excess redundancy for backup needs and for those cold peak days. We do need that in our world and our environment to have natural gas that's available for the basic needs of the South Central population. Under the scenarios that Analytica looked at, if there are large, whether it's export, whether it's a large industrial, just a big demander of natural gas, whenever you average it out, then that reduces the profile and the slopes of our demand needs, and it makes the need for the excesses smaller. So if we do have other industries, very, very good for us. If there are not other demanders of natural gas, then we're in a position where there will need to be significant excess gas that's available for the climate that we live in.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at the Singsa facility, so the current storage capacity is 11 BCF, but has future expansion capabilities to 17 BCF. If we don't get an anchor tenant, if the, you know, ConocoPhillips plant or the Agrium, something like that, doesn't come back online, and you're still, you know, have you as the major user, right, the major utility here, should we be thinking about opportunities for more storage? Does that help the profile at all?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, can I answer with one word? Yes.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. If we continue to have a very, very closed network, all options have to be looked at and be available. Storage is also, it's a very, very useful facility. It's not free, and it does come with a cost. And for NSTAR, we have about 70% of CINGSA we have committed under our firm contracts. And most of the cost of using CINGSA is under a 20-year take-or-pay contract where in warm years, where you don't need a whole bunch of that deliverability, you still have to use the infrastructure because it's your backup piece. We have been using it, and having it there in case that cold snap occurs, incredibly, incredibly important. But looking at an enhancement or an expansion of that facility going into the future, it should be part of what will be needed if we're in a place where we're not seeing the producers being able to come to the table. And where we're sitting right now with these existing contracts that Moira walked through, these contracts, along with CINGSA in its current state, are working for our existing needs. We don't have huge amounts of backup, but they are existing for the current needs.
And Mr. Chairman, follow up on that. Right now, it's the there's four utilities involved in this CINGSA. Is there additional interest from other utilities statewide, or I'm thinking like Seward or Homer or, you know, other nearby Cook Inlet region?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. Homer, as an example, is connected into the NSTAR system through a very good amount of work from a member of this committee a few years back. So they get to have access to the existing facility. Seward does not have natural gas currently. It would be a case where it'd have to be a distribution system installed into Seward, a method figured out on how to get gas to Seward. It's a long ways out there, but there are possibilities and options, something that, from NSTAR's perspective, we would love to be able to get out there and bring the low-cost gas to Seward. But as far as other interest into CINGSA, at this time, there have not been requests for additional use from the CINGSA facility outside of the four utilities who have signed up for the firm service. And of those, it's Chugach Electric has a significant amount of it. NSTAR uses a significant amount of it. It's a key asset for Homer Electric. They're a relatively small subscriber, but it's a nice little asset within their function. And then MLMP has a small portion as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. We're going to move on. There's no other questions. So we'll take a very brief at ease before we hear from the next presenter. Thank you very much. Welcome Mr. Tom Walsh, Brian Clements, and Mr. Doug Smith. Mr. Walsh is from Petrotechnical Resources. Mr. Clements is from Bristol Bay Industrial, and Mr. Smith is from the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
This is Brian Clemens. I am the chair of the Government Affairs Committee for the Support Industry Alliance. I am also a board member, with my colleagues here are also board members. And I am the president-elect of the Support Industry Alliance as well. Co-chair Nagyak and co-chair Tallarico, thank you so much for hearing our invited testimony today. Let me introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon. My name is Doug Smith. I'm the president and CEO of two ASRC subsidiaries, ASRC Construction Holding Company and Little Red Services.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Nagyak and Co-Chair Tallarico and members of the committee. My name is Tom Walsh. I'm managing partner of Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska, an integrated oil and gas consulting firm in Anchorage. I am also a member of the Alliance Board of Directors and the ad hoc member of the Executive Committee.
Proceed.
Let's first move to the slide number two and take a look. We are Alaskans. The Support Industry Alliance is made up of service providers and contractors that provide goods and services to resource developers. We're all about responsible resource development for the benefit of Alaska and Alaskans. And it's important to really focus on that and really think about what we're trying to say here, because some are real quick to dismiss our words and forget that we are nearly 600 Alaska businesses who employ over 30,000 Alaskans. And since our inception, exploration and producing companies have not been allowed to be members of our organization. In recent weeks, we've seen people taking positions and making decisions based on the premise that we're done as an oil and gas economy here in Alaska. But we know, and those who have testified before us know, there still exists great potential here. None of the other revenue streams being discussed can even come close to generating the revenue that resource development does. So instead of putting the last nail in the coffin of this industry, we should be doing our best as a state to incentivize future production. In the five times, this will be the sixth if HB 247 goes through, but in the five times oil taxes have been changed in the last 10 years, the message has always been the same. We need a stable investment climate. The message still stays the same today. We need that stable investment climate. So instead of asking yourselves, how much more can we take, you should ask yourselves, what is the state's policy to ensure we maintain a partnership with industry that benefits Alaskans? Just yesterday, Governor Walker stated, quote, "My administration and I will continue to work with the legislature so that we can make Alaska attractive to investors." HB 247 does not make Alaska attractive to investors. Next slide. We've heard a lot of questions during testimony about compromise on this bill. There is no compromise. This is just plain bad policy. There is no compromise that doesn't result in significant job losses for Alaskans. Any additional tax on the industry will result in serious consequences to our state economy. Passage of HB 247 would result in continued declining revenues to the state that cannot be replaced. Also, we've repeatedly heard the words, everybody needs to give. With all due respect, our industry has been doing the majority of the giving to the general fund for years, not to mention the contributions to the communities and nonprofits throughout our state by our Alaskan companies and their employees. I'd like to now turn it over to Doug to discuss a little bit more about impacts and implications relative to North Slope. Next slide, which would be slide number 4.
Good afternoon. I want to give you guys a little color on where we are today as service companies, and specifically I'll use my company as an example. So you understand that we are already in a state of crisis. Now, I've lived here through three oil price downturns. You guys were here probably in the 80s, the 90s, 98 when it was $9 for a little while, and now we're into another trough. Having gone through those, the general public recognizes we're in crisis mode when our housing prices are low or crashed, when there's homes sitting empty or bankrupt, and when there's obvious decrease in purchases of goods and services in our communities. And what we've learned over the years is not to knee-jerk react to the price of oil in our industry, and we've been doing that the last 18 months. The first thing we did as an industry was take it off the top line of our profits. You know, I have not had a layoff of any personnel at Little Red Services since the peak of the recession in 2009. We lost four people. We survived through that. We managed to benefit the last few years of an uptick in price and activity. We built some new units. We stimulated the economy. We built those in Anchorage, not out of state. And last year, we made a choice to protect our market share and protect our jobs. Our employee average experience is over 6 years at our company in tenure, and that's a very valuable resource for us. So we took significant profit impacts and reduced our rates. We were hoping for a recovery in price of oil. As you guys know, since January, it's plummeted, and now we're at stage two. Our producers are in a bind. They are negative cash flow. I understand that. We have, unfortunately, as of yesterday, we did our first layoffs at our company since 2009, and we are not at the end of it. Yesterday, we lost almost $2 million in payroll in the number of people we had to release, and this is strictly activity-driven. This is not to regain profitability from our side. This is hot oil units no longer working in the field, and transports no longer taking fluid to those units. What does it mean to us as Alaskans? Okay, the work we do is in the well intervention section. We go out, we do hot oil jobs on wells, we clear them of paraffin, we support acid jobs. We do things that have an immediate potential production increase on wells. Kind of the last line of things you will trim out of your activity in a declining market. And we are there. You know, I'm not sure if this committee is aware, but we are closely approaching a 60% decrease in rig activity from just a year ago. And we support your rig activity through freeze protection and other activities when the wells come back online. And so as I looked at our business right now is not about profit. Our business is about protecting market share and protecting our customer relationship. And as an Alaskan, I look at this and say, this is the same business decision you guys are in. Do we protect our market share of resource development, and do we protect the future potential revenue of that market share, or do we take from that market now and live with the consequences? And that's for you to decide, and it's a tough decision. I appreciate that. But know that there's not any more levers to pull in the industry. Between the companies and ourselves as service companies, We're at the crux now where any additional cost to industry results in some type of reaction. The only direction we have left now is to decrease activity or to take capital projects off the table. And just know that our state and us as residents will have to make the choices to move forward, but they will not be without consequence if we pull additional tax revenue from the industry. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, you said, through the chair, you said that there's a 60% decrease in rig activity. Were you speaking of your clients, or is that a... the reason I'm asking is that would seem to self-correct what I'm told could exceed $1 billion in credits. Theoretically, they'd become $400 million in credits. Is that what you're saying, or what?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so the credits are not as, and I'm not going to speak for oil companies here, and I'm not a tax expert, although I spent a lot of time on SB 21. What I will say is that this is a wide range of activity. These vary from coil units doing infield work, sidetracking existing wells, and legacy fields. These are rotary rigs. These are development rigs. So there's a wide bandwidth of activity we're talking about as a slowdown. So not all of that is in the line of credit. So as far as self-correcting the potential threat of the credit volume, we'd be talking apples and oranges a little bit there.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Seaton?
Thank you. And there's two different kind of policies mixed in this bill. One is tax credit. I mean, one is taxes, the 5% instead of the 4%, mm-hmm. and whether you can write off against the floor. And the other is looking at credits, which is the main aspect of this bill. And so I was trying to figure out, when you were talking about taxes, were you talking about just total of anything that's done, or were you talking about taxes and not addressing necessarily the credits or the state money as refundable credits?
Through the chair, Bruce Seaton, I understand the question, and you know, it's both for us. We are the sole supplier of the service across the North Slope. I have a unit working for Kalis right now that will be coming offline as they wrap up their exploration work. So we, as we work for these independents, whether it be NUNA with Kalis, we're doing work for Kalis currently, any of those groups that are dependent as new entrants, and if you remember during SB 21, a lot of the membership here was very adamant about the importance of these new entrants, and I agree with that. It's been a lot of our market opportunity. I think it's a lot of Alaska's future. And so they're in a different position than our legacy owners, and I think Those credits are very important, and, you know, as you spoke the last day or two about net present value, you know, I have equipment that I spent millions of dollars on the last couple of years that are now idle, and my original net present value calculations are no longer valid because it has a 10-year plus life cycle. But I think as we look at the investment through credits, I think about that a lot because it's our money that we're putting out there. Is what is my total return? And I look at it the same way we look at the Alaska Marine Highway. That study was good because it demonstrates the value of that system statewide. I think when we look at investments, you got to look at everything, the jobs, the trickle-down economy, the eventual return. Oil will not be 30-some-odd dollars forever. If it was, I would not bother coming here. It's going to be better someday. And so I think we've got to look longer-term versus near-term on those type of investments.
Okay, thanks. And just one more. You know, on the net present value we were looking at was a 30-year lifespan of the entire field.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, when we were looking at losses over at a price of $60 per barrel, should we not be looking at those kinds of prices, $60 and $80? Should we only... I mean, should we look and say, oh, this is a good investment because it's going to be $130 a barrel, and so then we don't have to worry? I mean, what is the kind of projection that you look at as far as your outlook as far as price per barrel and what activity those will generate?
So, through the chair, I understand the problem we have is trying to forecast oil price, which we are all demonstrated we're incapable of, including myself. However, we have built an industry and a business that's around a sort of $100 range of activity as far as price goes. So we are all backpedaling and readjusting to see how do we survive in a lower price environment. One of the things that I will tell you on the future of credits and investment is we are going to be a leaner, lower cost industry because of this exercise going forward. So recalibrating our cost to develop, recalibrating what it's going to cost to operate, is still finding its way to the top. We are not going to be quite as expensive to exist here in Alaska than we have been the last several years. You know, we are looking in every corner of our businesses for efficiency, and we're finding those. It's easy to look over those when oil is $100 a barrel. So I think right now, any model we pick from the history, the current recent history, to forecast what it's going to cost to produce oil is probably not very sound right now. I think we'll be able to demonstrate the ability to be pretty effective in the $70 to $90 range as we have trimmed a lot from our organizations and have gotten a lot better, and we have room to go.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple questions. You know, one, just thinking kind of the life cycle of your company and going back, you know, to the early 2000s, so say like 15 years ago when we were still under ELF, there was not a lot of activity going on in early stage exploration kind of activity. It sounds like your company trying to figure out like where you fit in that profile, and if we looked at that timeline, you know, was your company active during that time period, or, you know, have you ramped up more recently? And then in the second part of it is in thinking about your investment decisions, one of the other factors that I would think would influence is it's really cheap to borrow money right now. And just how does that, you know, kind of separate that from what is happening, you know, with this tax structure? But I would think that that would make, you know, some of these big equipment purchases more desirable activities, you know, in a you know, if you can borrow it more cheaply.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we're actually a cash buyer on our equipment, so I don't have to pay any interest on that. When we purchased it, we had, you know, we were kind of a pay-as-we-go type company. We don't like debt. But going back to the first question about longevity, the company has been around since 1983.
Okay.
And so we were active through the 2000s as always doing the infield support work. We provide the freeze protection. Production stops, we're the fire department. If you shut down taps, we go out and freeze protect 2,000 wells. And so we've been active in that arena, but as new entrants came into the market, in Alaska and started stepping out, and as Conoco's gone west and other Point Thompson was developed, you know, we've had opportunity to extend our services out into those areas. There's also been, you know, during the lead up to and after SB 21, there was quite a bit of new spend infield, and we actually added about 30 employees in that range of time. And that's when we had our last big equipment pushed, and we were committed to building those here in Anchorage. We built those at a small fab shop that I went by day before yesterday. They were had 60 employees when I built those units, and they have 7 guys working on the floor today and 3 staff, and they are just barely keeping the doors open. So this has been felt pretty deeply in the industry of all service levels, our current condition. So I think we're going to, as residents living in South Central and Anchorage specifically, 2016 is going to demonstrate some very visible things to us, I think, in the way of housing and other that we're in a recession in our industry already.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Go ahead and your presentation.
Thank you, Coach Arnagyak. Tom Walsh again with PRA, and I will be speaking briefly on the Middle Earth area and Cook Inlet. And I want to kind of get through this quickly because one of my favorite clients is coming up behind me, Chugach Electric, and I'm sandwiched between NSTAR and Chugach, which are both clients of PRA's. So I want to leave them time. I don't think we'll have time for any questions of me, unfortunately, though. So I just want to start off by talking about PRA's qualifications. We've worked extensively with Doyon Limited in their exploration of the Nanana Basin and Yukon Flats as well. And we are working with them currently on their drilling program that will commence this summer in Nanana with another well. So we've worked a lot on Middle Earth projects. We have not worked Copper Center, and although we've discussed with Nana their thoughts on exploration in their region, we haven't really done any active work up there. But I'd like to say that the policy that generated SB 21 was very sound, and it's clearly meeting its objectives, in my view, all over the state of Alaska. I think it has obviously been a very significant uptick in activity, both exploration and development. And so it really is meeting its objectives that it was intended to meet. There has been a significant amount of activity, and, of course, in Middle Earth, Doyon and Atna and Nana are all in various stages of exploration. Doyon is, again, drilling another exploration well this year. They're shooting a seismic program right now with the support of tax credits for Middle Earth. Atna is getting ready to drill their first well in the Copper Center. So it really has had an impact in those areas, and they're critical areas for the growth of oil and gas development in the state of Alaska. The potential that's out there, and this is just for Nanana Basin, Nanana is estimated to contain up to 234 million barrels of oil, as well as 5.6 trillion TCF of gas. So although there's been no discovery, no commercial discovery in Nanana at this point, there is significant potential out there. And a well that finds oil and gas in the Nanana Basin, such as the well that's being drilled this year, would be a huge home run for Doyon and for the state of Alaska, both in terms of jobs and fuel stability, of course, for these rural areas. So some of the projects that are going on right now, in my view, Doyon is the poster child for successful Middle Earth investment driven by tax credits. Doyon has invested every penny that they've received in tax credits in exploration, and then when they get the credit money back, they reinvest, and they have gone through several cycles of exploration in the Nanana Basin. And I think they've just been really an ideal case for the function of these tax credits. And they are very critical, those tax credits, going forward for Doyon. I know you'll be hearing from Doyon, I believe, either in written testimony or oral testimony later, and they'll certainly give you some more details on that. But the changes that are to occur by sunsetting of some of the tax credits that are in effect right now will fall right in the middle of their drilling season. So those are very significant for them and causes them great alarm for the projects they've got ongoing. Otna is in a similar situation. They're planning their first well this summer, and they're very much at the beginning of their exploration cycle. But again, if gas or oil is discovered in Copper Center, it will be hugely impacting for for Alaskans. So these projects are they're huge potential benefit for Alaskans in terms of jobs and, as I mentioned, local and rural fuel supply. My concern is that instability and changes to the tax structure at this point in time are very damaging to those types of projects. And I just appeal to you to not kill these projects through either intentional or collateral impacts of HB 247. I think they're absolutely critical to those projects. My experience with the activities in Middle Earth, we are one of the companies that's worked for Doyon, but they are very focused on local hire and workforce development, as you probably know. So we've been working with them closely, and as have many other contractors, and we feel that our work will be significantly impacted negatively with changes that are imposed by HB 247. We have done some work for Doyon on the sensitivities of impact of HB 247, and I'm going to leave that for them to go over with you in terms of detail of how those changes will impact Doyon in particular. Let me just move quickly through Cook Inlet, and we heard some fantastic testimony, I thought, yesterday. I was able to watch on gavel to gavel, and so really I think the producers have given you their view, and explorers have given you their view on the impacts of HB 247, and I don't need to go into that detail. And the utility companies, NSTAR today, and I believe Chugach after us, will give you the impacts associated with the utility companies. But again, the incentives are working. We've heard from the producers, we'll hear, and we have heard from the utility companies. We heard from former Mayor Dan Sullivan in an op-ed piece in June 2015 about how very successful these incentives have been for Cook Inlet and how they have brought us to a point where we really are stable again in terms of energy supply. PRA produced a report in 2009 and updated it in 2012, which many of you may remember us coming down and testifying on, that we were running out of gas in Cook Inlet Basin. We thought we were going to have to import LNG. We're not at that space anymore because of the incentives that have been offered and the activity that has occurred there. Oil production has risen from 7.5 million barrels a day in 2009 to almost 18 million barrels a day today. Gas production has stabilized, and there's still a perceived shortage in the market. We've talked about beyond 2023 where we'll be, and you'll hear more about that from Chugach, I know. One thing I heard yesterday was the announcement about the new contract between NSTAR and Hilcorp, and we heard more about that today from NSTAR. The fact of the matter is that that gas is still in the ground, and it, as Dave Wilkins from Hilcorp yesterday indicated, there are projects that need to take place to produce that gas, and there's funding required to carry out those projects. And a change in the tax structure, in particularly in terms of credits, will have an impact on the development of those gas molecules to get them to their clients. Other factors, the unemployment in Kenai declined from 11% to 7% over this recent period of activity, and our alliance membership in the Kenai area has grown from 40 to 102. So lots of activity and lots of potential, 600 billion barrels of oil potential in Cook Inlet Basin, 1.18 TCF of gas estimated to be yet to develop. Those are from the USGS. And really the benefit from jobs, energy stability, and royalty is something that is critical to the future of these two basins. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Further questions? If not, thank you very much for your
I think they're not quite done.
Huh?
They may not quite have done.
A few more slides, if you may.
Oh, I thought you were done.
Mr. Chairman. So,
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just before we get too far off of that, can you remind me, with all of the Middle Earth activity, what the envisioned infrastructure or delivery system is, if there is a discovery, or is that to get into the Fairbanks network, or?
Yes, Representative Tarr, through the chair. The plans right now are really dependent on whether it's oil that is discovered or gas, and how much, really. So in Nanana Basin, anyway, we're very close to TAPS, and the idea for oil would be to bring it to TAPS. For gas, obviously, supply to the local market would be something that would be very beneficial. It probably would not be a big enough market to really make it a tremendous commercial success for Doyon. Mm-hmm. But again, tying into export facilities or the grid would be the plan for both a large or a small find in Nanana.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Okay, so a bit more about jobs. We are on slide number 7 now. West Virginia got it right. The West Virginia Senate is considering a measure to reduce the state's coal and natural gas tax rates. And according to their Senate Majority Leader, quote, "We believe that it will create jobs, and we believe it will put West Virginia at a more competitive advantage." And what's being proposed here with HB 247 would do exactly the opposite for the state of Alaska. So we're all about jobs. Jobs are our future. A former state commissioner used that as their tagline. Unfortunately, right now, as you've heard the testimony, the support industry right now are really hemorrhaging jobs. We're losing jobs by the boatload. Between December 2014 and December 2015, from a Department of Labor study, we lost around 1,000 jobs in the industry. We actually did a survey of our members, and through that survey, we would believe that that number is actually understated, and it's much greater than that. And as we had that conversation with our members, we asked a question about what the expectations were for the future. And we believe that given the data that our members have given us, it'll significantly exceed 1,000 jobs in 2016. And there's a multiplicative effect. So let's go to slide number 8. And what you see here is just one single dimension of the things that we do there in the oil and gas industry. And it's all about, you talk about rigs. Rigs are used either for workovers, or they're primarily in two categories. They're either for workovers, existing infield, go into the existing wells and make them flow better. Or it's for exploration. This is probably a conservative look at the number of positions that is required to support a drilling operation for the drilling contractor only. So it's 44 positions, and the total economic benefit from through that drilling company would be close to $2 million a month. $24 million a year. It also should be noted that the 44 positions is positions up on the North Slope. We actually do a rotational things, as many of you know, and that's 88 jobs. And to take that a little bit further, to kind of look at that a little bit further, you have drilling support that goes along with that. Doug talked about that a little bit, the hot oil, the rig up, the rig down, the laborers that support that, fluid hauling, equipment hauling, and that's just right there at the well site itself, the drill site itself. And that almost doubles that number of folks that are impacted. And then you have in near infrastructure associated with housing, building, feeding, transportation. You've got camps and housekeeping and security, travel folks, all of that supporting. And then having, again, the multiplicative effect.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Can you explain the column, the 2,000 per position? Is that?
So yeah. Basically, that's cost of labor and associated. It's a very round billing rate. So the specific numbers there were either rounded up or rounded down to the nearest, $100, $200 really. And so that is the, for that particular position, for a day. So that's a day rate.
Day.
Okay. That's a day rate.
Okay, there okay? we go. How to
add that. Yeah. Trying to
yeah, good question.
What's the POS?
So in the multiplicative effect even goes further. We've got a lot of folks that are supporting all of that infrastructure and all of those people that are deployed up on the North Slope locally and within some of your communities and some of your constituents. And again, those folks are going to restaurants and merchants, are selling them goods, and you got the yard. So all the way down, and we could go on, and all the way down to the coffee shop on the corner where the barista's selling you coffee. So a lot of jobs. In fact, if you looked at just a single rig, when they lay down a single rig, it might reach just that 1,000 folks pretty quick when it comes to just the people that are involved throughout the entire supply chain. So year on year, as you heard before, we have had a reduction of 60% in rig activity due to low oil prices and a negative cash flow. And we've sensed an unsympathetic attitude toward the oil companies when they discuss their negative cash flow. But make no mistake about it. In this environment of low oil prices, our alliance member companies are experiencing the same pressures. You know, first we've gone through many rounds of looking at our costs and reducing our costs. And then we looked at our markups. And in fact, a lot of our member companies are already at break-even markups or are experiencing negative cash flows. Then we have to look at wages. And yes, many of our member companies have already taken a look at wages and reduced wages, are thinking about reducing wages, or will reduce wages in the near future. And then we lose jobs. So this is just the tip of the iceberg right now with this low oil price environment. And this impacts working Alaskans from every district represented here in Juneau. So let's go to the conclusion, slide number 9. One might ask, can HB 247 impact an LNG project? Any LNG project of any size or scope faces challenges, including low commodity prices and lack of capital. But one factor that you can influence as policymakers is a stable tax structure. HB 247 negatively impacts a future LNG project for Alaska. Future oil production is the bridge to any LNG project because the revenue stream generated is needed to develop that pipeline. We need that healthy oil production in Alaska moving forward. The state and the industry cannot control oil prices, but be sure that industry has weathered this storm before and knows how to batten down the hatches until oil prices recover. The state can sink the ship by overtaxing. Let's not invoke a policy that further decreases jobs and erodes our needed competencies required to respond when oil prices and investment increases again, and they will. And what I mean by that is that we're already experiencing these job losses. HB 247 creates a high likelihood that the last of our core competencies that we need to respond to future development will suddenly erode and be gone. So the question for you as policymakers is, do we want slow progress or no progress? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Tara?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go back a slide to the rig personnel and make sure I understand, you know, say just the top line here, the company rep, you're saying they're two per rig, that's a $2,000 a day daily rate. You're counting it for 30 days for a total of $60,000, saying that each of those individuals makes $720,000 a year?
No, you got to remember there's a rotation.
But that includes that, so, because so, the 120,000 divided by two.
Some of those higher-end employees. Remember that this is a total economic benefit mm-hmm. coming through the drilling company mm-hmm. into the economy. So mm-hmm. so okay. it's and yes, those higher end rig personnel do make very good money.
Okay,
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You know, I mean, I really appreciate the situation you are in, we're in, everything else, but it sounds like the recommendation is that you're going to cut costs, you're going to do those things, but the state should not. The state should continue to give, last year it was $628 million of refundable tax credits to the oil industry, about half and or two-thirds of that in Cook Inlet, half of it on the North Slope, and we limited that to $500 million this last year. It'll be $623 million next year when we're running a $3.8 billion deficit. We should raise other taxes, you know, go to some other source of money, whether that's reducing permanent fund dividends or income taxes or whatever we should do, but we should continue spending that money in refundable tax credits without any limitations. And do you, I mean, that's not giving us very much help in making a policy to say there should be no change in anything that the state's been doing. And so I would hope that the Alliance would come forward and give us some positive feedback on what kind of changes would be least impactful, but that are going to reduce our deficit, because I just don't think that we're going to be able to go forward and say we're just going to basically what you would do, go bankrupt to pay out money for something that may be there in the future or may not be. So anyway, I would hope that you would send us some.
So things. Representative Seaton, through the chair. You know, I think that it goes back from our position, it's all about policy. And so, you know, I'm not a tax expert either, and I think it's, if you look at other producing states and when they're hurting in this regard, they're not taking away from the incentives that will ensure that they're in a position in the future to take advantage of future oil production or oil and gas production, but instead they're keeping the investment, they're making it stable, or they're trying to create more incentives for the oil and gas to stick around and make sure that they continue with their endeavors. Anybody else like to comment as well?
But the cost of doing business is much lower than it is up here. Cost of doing business is very high here. And it's lower cost down in the lower 48. They have roads, they have infrastructure, they have all kinds of things. It's much cheaper to do business down there than it is up here. So, you know, when you start decrying about that stuff, you know, you're talking about apples and oranges, because it's a whole lot cheaper down there and a whole lot more expensive up here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clemens, a couple of things following up on what Representative Seaton said and your comment about, and I know you weren't, I hope, referring to me, the comment about being unsympathetic. I couldn't be more sympathetic. If you exclude Good Friday in March 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, it's all roses for me. It really is. I mean, I was born here in 1964. I see how industry has transformed the state for the better. And I want to help. But since I sat down this afternoon in this chair, my state has bled $500,000 in red ink, just since I sat down. One of your slides, you talked about compromise, that there isn't compromise. Following up on what Representative Seaton said, there has to be a pathway forward. I've heard fantastic arguments yesterday in particular and today from Fury and from Hillcorp. And so we're trying to meld all that and achieve some win-win, as I said yesterday, result. But I don't know if you want to respond to that. The West Virginia model for me doesn't work, by the way. That is a state that has, I think, devastated its natural environment. So
It's great if that's where you want to go, but it's not where I want to go. But I'd love to hear anything you have to say.
Yes, Representative Josephson, through the chair, this is Tom Walsh. I would like to make a couple of comments. I think something you said earlier, Representative Josephson, is worth mentioning again, and that is whether this will be somewhat self-correcting. We're talking about reductions in activity that have occurred because of the low oil price, the low commodities price. Those reductions in activity, we think, will be compounded with changes in the tax structure. And as we heard yesterday, there are projects that are ongoing right now that have done their economics and their commercial analysis based on the tax structure being stable. When PRA does a commercial analysis or due diligence for someone and projects forward the commercial viability of a project, we assume the tax structure is going to be stable. We can't guess. We also assume some type of model for the oil price, and we can't guess at that either. But I'd like to think that we could assume that this tax structure is going to be stable. What we heard yesterday from the producers is they're in the middle of these projects that they have funded and sanctioned within their companies based on the tax structure that's in place right now. If you change that right now, that blows them out of the water, and it gives the state of Alaska such poor credibility. It really is the wrong thing to do as far as policy. One other thing to mention, I do think there will be self-correction because of that lowering of activity, and I expect certainly that the applications for credits will be lower in future years until things turn around.
Just a comment, if I may, on Mr. Walsh's remark. That argument that you raised about sort of pulling the rug out is an outstanding argument, and it's one I take very seriously. Relative to the tax scheme changes, I'm tempted to say, and I guess I'm going to say it, my party has not played a very great role in that. Well, I suppose we did in the ACES period, so I retract that comment. But there have been a lot of changes. I wasn't here for those, and I think that we hope that those changes slow. So I hear you on that.
Representative Skidmore.
Thank you. And I appreciate those comments, and that's some of the ideas that we were soliciting yesterday, and on projects, whether they're in the reach final investment decision, whether they haven't, should those all be treated the same? I mean, $600 million spent on tax credits, some of which are going to produce nothing for a while, maybe in the future, and some that could be very critical to ongoing things that have reached final investment decision. And is there some time frame under which, like they said in Cook Inlet, at some point you declare success and you take another tack? But all we're hearing coming forward is don't change anything. Everybody should get the state should be in exactly the same position it is. It should spend itself into bankruptcy if it needs to, but keep everything the same. We need some input from industry as to what are the parameters, policy parameters, that we should put forward to limit our expenditure when we don't have the money to expend, and yet support the decisions that have been made that have reached that point. So we're asking for those things. So far we haven't heard them. All we've heard is don't change anything, everybody, no changes at all. And I don't think that's going to be the case. So if that's not going to be the case, either through policy decisions or vetoes, which are not as good as policy decisions, I think, we're going to have to lower expenditures. So we would like your help in designing those. So thank you.
So may I respond to that, Mr. Co-Chair?
Go ahead.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. I understand, and in my particular case, PRA works throughout the basins in Alaska, and really when I talk to my clients and see how these impacts are affecting my company, they are across the board. And the bottom line is stability creates investment and instability ruins investment. And what I see that we are doing as the state of Alaska is we are trying to increase taxes when things are good and the price of oil is high, and then when we get in dire straits, as the oil industry is right now, and the prices are low and we're hemorrhaging and they're hemorrhaging, we're trying to increase taxes again or reduce our investment in the industry. You know, we can't have it both ways. We can't increase on the high end and increase on the low end. We're trying to use the tax credit system in Alaska or the tax system for oil and gas as a hedge fund and say, oh, we're hedged against this. We can just start charging the oil industry more to cover our revenue that we require to meet our service needs. It's not a hedge fund. If we compare ourselves to a nationalized oil company like Saudi Arabia, what are they doing right there? Now, they don't have anyone to scapegoat and say, you're going to pay more taxes. They own the industry. They are dipping into their funds, their source of funding that they have put away just like we have. So I think for people that want to believe that we're an owner state and that we should have a bigger share of the pie, we ought to look at those NOCs and see what they're doing. And what they're doing is looking at their rainy day funds, and they're using them. Saudi Arabia needs $85 a barrel to be healthy. They're at 36, so they're dipping into those funds. That's, in my view, what we ought to be doing, not charging taxes at a higher rate.
Thank you. Any other comments? Oh, Representative Calvary.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, and I appreciate you coming forward and telling us what you think. It's not my responsibility to sit here and tell you what to think. I'm here to listen to what you have to tell us. So I do appreciate that. I think there will be some type of activity in what we're doing. We're going to have to figure something out, no question about it. But I do appreciate you coming forward, because I don't think it's easy for everyone to come forward and give us their point-blank honest evaluation. So I do appreciate that quite a bit. And just to reiterate what you had said, you represent about 30,000 employees throughout the Support Industry Alliance. Is that correct?
Around nearly 600 companies and more than 30,000 employees.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation. We'll take a brief ad for the next presentation. Back to order. Welcome Mr. Mark Fouts and Mr. Phil Steyer from Chugach Electric Association. Mr. Fouts is Director of Corporate Planning and Analysis, and Mr. Steyer is Director of Government Relations and Corporate Communications. Identify yourself for the record and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Steyer. I work for Chugach Electric, as does my colleague Mark Fouts. We have a short presentation. I will begin, and Mark will take up midway through with slides. My role here is to give you some perspective on Chugach's historic use of gas out of the inlet. Mark will pick up with where we are today and where we're headed in the future. When we look at the rail belt electrically, there are six different electric utilities in the rail belt that provide retail service. Each of those owns generation. For five of the six utilities, natural gas is the primary generation fuel. And for Representative Tallarico's area, the sixth utility, Golden Valley, considers natural gas part of its generation portfolio as well, because it buys gas-generated power from South Central Utilities. So the point here is that natural gas is vitally important to electric generation in the rail belt, has been for decades, and we foresee that continuing. And it's important to note that for us, all of our gas supply comes out of the Cook Inlet Basin. When you look at the rail belt as a picture, these are color-coded to show the individual service territories of the six electric utilities in the rail belt. And I want to say that even though Mark and I work for Chugach, and our comments here are going to be Chugach-specific, By extension, there are four different electric utilities in the Rail Belt that use natural gas as their primary generation fuel. And so there's a great deal of commonality between what we're going to tell you as Chugach and what Homer Electric or Municipal Light and Power, Matanuska Electric, would perhaps be telling you if they were here. Chugach's gas situation has changed quite a bit over time. There was a period from the 60s to the 80s when our contracts, I guess I would characterize as very large volumes, long-term, gas was inexpensive. We had three separate producers. We received what I refer to as full service, meaning the producers basically did everything, and we were the customer that took gas from them, and they were responsible for what it took to get us gas where we needed it. The gas we bought met the needs of multiple utilities, and that's because Chugach had long-term contracts with other utilities where we generated power on and sold to other utilities. So the gas we purchased met the needs of multiple utilities. We got into a period then from the 1980s to recently when things changed a bit. We were able to secure large volume, long-term contracts again. The price I've characterized now is reasonable versus inexpensive, and there's some historical perspective on that. But prices were reasonable. We added a producer, which was a good thing. So we now had four producers. And again, the service we received was full service. And once again, the gas we purchased met the needs of multiple utilities. We're currently in a period that Mark will expand on here, but to characterize our contracts these days, contracts are for smaller volumes, shorter duration, limited service. We do much more of what's necessary to ensure we have gas delivered to the point where we need to burn it. We do have multiple producers, and that's a good thing. And today the gas we purchase meets the needs of Chugach retail customers as well as the Seward electric system. So I believe it was Representative Tarr, you had asked a question about CINGSA. CINGSA gains a benefit through Chugach's contractual share of CINGSA. So the Seward electric system benefits in CINGSA through Chugach's contract because we are their wholesale power provider.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Starr, when you say full service in the 80s and 90s and last decade, now limited service, give me an example of what you mean.
In the old days, we said we need this much gas a day, and we had multiple power plants where we might burn that. Mm-hmm. And the producers said okay and provided an amount per day delivered where we needed it. These days, to perhaps oversimplify, we say we need this much gas a day, and they say, okay, you can have it here, and if you want to move it over there, if you want to use it over there, it's now the utility's responsibility to have a contractual arrangement with somebody who owns a pipeline along the way to get it from where they produce it to where we need to use it. And so there's been a shift to the utility in better defining our daily requirements, actually hour-by-hour requirements, and in arranging for a transmission path that formerly was provided.
Okay.
Mark will be capable of expanding on that if there's continuing interest. Chugach is not solely dependent upon natural gas. We're mostly dependent upon natural gas. And to some degree, this is true for the other utilities as well. But we have a renewable energy portion of our generation portfolio that we're proud of and we're happy to have. One reason but that only accounts for about 15 to 20% of our generation need in an average year, and that's because that's all it's capable of meeting. And to some degree, we need less gas currently than we used to because we make more efficient use of gas. We built a new power plant along with Municipal Light and Power that uses only about 3/4 the amount of gas to make a kilowatt hour as the generation it replaced. And so we, in part in recognition of the situation about the Cook Inlet gas basin, we have tried to take steps to be as responsible on our side as a customer as we can be. But that said, natural gas is critically important to electric generation in South Central. It is the generation fuel that provides about 85% of the needs, again, of multiple utilities in South Central and to some lesser degree in the interior through purchases of South Central generated gas. And uncertainty about the supply or the deliverability of that gas creates concern. And let me remind you of what concern looks like. In 2009, Chugach and other utilities and the municipality of Anchorage and the boroughs north and south of Anchorage came together and put together what we referred to as the Energy Watch Program. And we produced this poster, and at the heart of it is this chart. And the reason we did this was there was concern about what happens if any time round the clock, round the year, but really in particular on a cold, dark winter night, what happens if there's not enough gas deliverability to meet everyone's needs? And so we prepared for what we referred to as an energy emergency. And that was a place we did not like being, and frankly, that's a place we don't want to go back to if we can avoid that. And with that, I'm going to turn the clicker over to my colleague, Mark, and he'll take it from here.
To the chair, is Mark Fouts. I've been with Chugach Electric for about 25 years. In the last 10 years, well, actually, if I started back when I started, we signed a gas contract with a major producer for 250 Bs. Use it when you'd like to. 20 years later, we used it up. We knocked on the door again and said, we'd like some more gas. And they said, well, about 2 years, with an option for two more at our option. And we were kind of stunned as to what happened. What happened with that gas producer was he found another place in the world to make more money. And he was done with the gas business in Cook Inlet. 2009, 2010, we know what the price of oil was, and that's where that producer went. And Conoco also was a major producer at the time, and they offered us 6 years. Actually, it was 4 years, and they said, well, actually, it was 3 years, but we'll give you three more, but we're not going to give it to you with any swing. It's just going to be flat gas. Well, there was no storage facility in Cook Inlet at that time. We had to make that decision. And as Representative Josephson asked earlier, what service was it before? What kind of service do we have from the major gas companies? We had the full service. The dispatch centers for electric didn't even schedule gas. It just showed up at the power plants whenever we needed it. And by the time we got done with the majors leaving, we were doing the transport, we were doing the storage, we were doing the swing. We took up everything, took care of everything. And what I wanted to kind of share here is not so much the story of what it was like back in 2009 and 10 when we were looking for more gas supply for another 20 years. It comes down to two key terms. And I know you've heard them, and I know you know what they mean. I'm going to try to provide a little more insight into what the volume of gas in Cook Inlet is and what it means to Chugach and what the deliverability is. So back in 2011, I think the state put out this chart and explained that these four major gas fields in Cook Inlet are declining. And as we all know, in this state, the decline curve goes down to the right. What the state also did in 2010 and 2011, recognizing that Chevron and Marathon were leaving the Cook Inlet, they went to Houston and looked for another producer. As you all know, that producer became Hillcorp. And what you don't see on this chart from the last 5 years is what Hillcorp did, and they stopped the decline. So 5 years ago, we had 1.2 Cs of P2 gas, and today we have 1.2 Ts. That was very valuable for us in terms of our supply, in terms of our volume. To show how Chugach fits into this, I have a chart here that shows how much gas we use and where we get our gas from. And this year, we're going to get a part of our gas from ConocoPhillips, the last year of that six-year contract. And then for the next 7 years, Hillcorp largely provides our gas supply. Chugach has also acquired a 10% interest in one of the largest fields in Cook Inlet to provide a small portion of our gas supply. But what this chart shows is that of this 10% of the gas being produced in Cook Inlet, we use that 10%. And by 2023, a number we've heard many times today and last week, that's it. That's 7 years of supply. When we were in 2010, 2011, we were 4 to 5 years away from running out of gas, so to say. We were running out of people who were willing to invest in Cook Inlet was the problem. And the state solved that by bringing Hillcorp to Alaska, and Hillcorp made that $200 to $300 million investment every year, and we are where we are today. My concern from having been at the negotiating table with Marathon and Chevron and ConocoPhillips 5 years ago is when they get ready to pack their bags and leave to go to someplace else, the first thing they do is they stop investing. When the well waters up, they don't do any more with it. And that's exactly what happened. If in 2 to 3 years, Hillcorp, Fury, Bluecrest, AIX, Aurora, Cook Inlet Energy, or NORDAC all decide that there's a better place to invest their money, in 2 years we'll be right back where we were in 2010. We'll be 5-6 years away from nobody willing to invest in Cook Inlet. We've already made a $356 million investment with MLMP on a power plant that is designed to last till 2048. We have a 7-year supply, that's certain. We would really like to have a longer-term lead time than being lead time away to find an alternative supply. In 2005 or 2010, we actually basically met weekly as electric utilities trying to figure out where we're going to get gas from, talking from parties who could build ships for us, talking to sources of LNG, CNG from around the world. So the story on supply is very important. The story on supply depends on investment. The other aspect of our business, in my next two slides, is the word deliverability. And I think NSTAR expressed that they have almost all the deliverability they need. Well, in our business, in electric business, we have 30% extra capacity in our generation. So when one generator may trip or due to equipment failure, we still have enough electricity to meet the need. In terms of deliverability of gas supply, because CINGSA was recognized as needed and funded, GAP subscribed to enough deliverability from CINGSA to again provide that redundancy. Not only can we meet the instantaneous peak, and what you see on this chart is an hourly projection of our gas needs. The base is in blue, the red is in, or the peaking's in red. You can see how much the gas can vary hour to hour. What NSTAR was speaking is in terms of days, the daily rate. On an hourly basis, even more swings required. And for Chugach, we have purchased enough deliverability from CINGSA to not only meet the need throughout the winter, but even weather and equipment failure, where we have to turn on the peaking units or two peaking units, and we still can meet the electric load. Because, as you all know, electric service and heating our homes is a critical service. One more slide here on how we look at each day when we use our gas. We receive our gas on a continuous basis all day long. During the evening hours when the load, electric load goes down because the lights are out, people are asleep, we actually are still getting that 22 million a day. And what we do is we put that gas in storage. As everybody wakes up when the load increases, the supplier does not provide enough gas. We actually pull that gas out of CINGSA. So unlike NSTAR, who's mainly using CINGSA to meet the peak in the winter, we use it every day. It's critical to meeting our load, and it provides the least cost fuel supply for Chugach because we're buying all our gas at flat rates. So we've invested in CINGSA. That was a $100 million commitment for 20 years. It would have been nice to have a 30 or 40-year commitment. 20 was available. So my point in my last slide is we have our gas needs met in terms of volume for 7 years. We have our storage facility for another 16 years under contract. And we have a generation asset that's good to 2048. If we find ourselves in that situation that we found ourselves in 2009, 10, 11, we were 5 years away from from a fuel supply that's uncertain, we're going to be right back where we were in 2010. And the way I look at it, if there was a metric, even though as the House Resources Committee, if you looked at Cook Inlet and someone says, is there enough supply? Is there enough deliverability? I say, when you have enough supply where we can go out 15 to 20 years, the problem is solved. When you have enough deliverability, when NSTAR says we're 10 short and they call me up and say, can we borrow some of your gas for the next 8 hours? We will more than gladly accommodate them. We already have agreements to do all that. But for me, for a state, they should be able to commercially go to the marketplace in Cook Inlet and buy an extra 10% of deliverability above what they need, so when that compressor goes down on a platform, they just call up the other platform owner and ask for an extra 10 million a day. If there were metrics going forward, there'd be two new gas platforms, at least in Cook Inlet, that could do 50 million a day, plus what Hillcorp is doing, plus what Sings is doing, then we're covered. So, just to kind of recap, DNR in 2009, 10, 11 came out with their study, we have a decline. Hillcorp came in and said, we'll cover your volume. We'll almost cover your deliverability. Deliverability is extremely expensive. You spend $100 million and try to get it back in 10 days on selling gas at $7 or $8, it doesn't pay for itself. The state in 2015 said there's 1.2, you've heard this last week from your consultant, 1.2 TCF of P2. As a person that does numbers for Chugach, that's 0.7 of proven. That's the infill. That's 0.5 of probable. That's what they hope to get. That's 50% probability. So we have 5 to 10 years of gas that the state believes we have. Hillcorp will do 7 years. Hillcorp's going to have to drill, as David Wilton said yesterday. He doesn't have all this gas behind the pipe. He's going to drill over the next 5 years, next 7 years, and he's going to be drilling some of that proven or probable reserves. Just like he said, he drilled one well, $12 million, got nothing out of it. He's going to be doing a lot more of that as these fields decline. And he's out looking for gas. You know how many stories I've heard if you go out and look for gas, and we're counting on it, and we're excited about it, and zero. We need security in terms of our fuel supply. And I guess I look at this committee as an opportunity to express from Chugach Electric's perspective, we need a long-term security. We really shouldn't be putting ourselves into 5 years, 6 years out and having the uncertainty of how we're going to meet the electric load. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think something that has to be a factor and consideration in this conversation is the work to integrate the rail belt utilities. And I know there's a piece of legislation out there that's been something we've been talking about to sort of build efficiency into the system. And I just wonder if you could give an update on the progress there so we can have that in the background.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tarr, there are multiple efforts to reduced amount of gas being burned by the electric utilities. The most certain effort is what the utilities already did. They all put in brand new, highly efficient generation. 5 years ago, we burned 33 Bs, just like NSTAR did, or does today. By the end of this year, well, start with 2017, we'll be burning about 28 Bs. We cut off 5 Bs of gas. We're also looking at dispatching all the generation together. Mm-hmm. That'll save another marginal piece, another marginal level of gas, not near as significant as the 5 Bs. And that's what's under study right now. So basically, the utilities, through their almost billion-dollar investment in new generation, has minimized the gas usage. By economically dispatching together, we'll save a marginal amount more. So most of the savings have probably already been accrued.
And just brief follow-up, Mr. Chairman. And when you say that, you mean that it's ISO? Is that the right term? I was trying to remember.
Right. There's several terms, but in general, there's a ISO or a USO. The idea is that all the utilities dispatch all their generation optimally, so no gas is wasted or no fuel.
Mm-hmm. And that is
the ISO, as you refer to.
Yes. Okay, and that's the ongoing piece that is going to be a marginal reduction in overall demand.
Well, the amount of gas being used, as I said, for next year and all the new power plants on, should be in the order of 28 Bs. Mm-hmm. And if the utilities optimize their dispatch, there could be another half a B or a B of gas that also could be saved. And that's the value of us economically dispatching. A B of gas is $8 million. $8 million forever is a lot of money.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. Mm-hmm. We will start again at 6 p.m. this evening with Ms. Marliana Hall. Thank you for Ms. Hall for your patience. We will adjourn at 2:52.